Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you back to my home. So thank you for showing up, and let's get on into it. I've had a pretty good day today. Saturday, so I cook as my main gig, and then on weekends and sometimes in evenings, I do janitorial work. It's kind of an interesting profession. I like it. I feel I'm suited to it. I wouldn't mind being a janitor. If I could get more financial gain out of it, you know, but I do it kind of as side work right now. And basically you have all these different accounts, and I clean factories, I clean medical offices, I cleaned all kinds of various different places, you know, like urgent clinics, dentist offices, orthodontic surgeons, basically all these kind of places that are generally pretty clean as is, and janitorial work's going on every single day. And so if it's moderately clean daily, it's super easy work, because I'm not really big into deep cleaning or any of that kind of shit. Like, my buddy used to clean cars, and I fucking hated it. You know, he'd spend hours detailing these vehicles, and that shit's fucking miserable. But pretty much all I do is I go in with a trash can and flip trash, and, you know, half the time I don't even take the bag. And then, you know, I go and clean and wipe out bathrooms with water. And then I go and vacuum, and then I mop. Most places take me less than an hour. You know, the hardest part is ferrying yourself from one location to the next. But I don't mind it, and I'm by myself, you know. And something that I've always enjoyed doing, I've been doing for several years, is microdosing psilocybin for work. And nothing towards the point of being fucked up. Like, I just had this whole conversation with this person on Reddit, so you can imagine the tone of this conversation. If you don't know, Reddit is a very volatile place. You know, people go on there just to fight, it seems like. But we were discussing opiate addiction, you know, and it was on a 70H forum, and I was trying to describe to a person who was criticizing others for taking, you know, kratom or 7-hydroxy at work as being negligent because they're just trying to get fucked up at work. And I tried to explain to him, you know, that things change over time, and we sort of adapt to our situations, and we end up on these chemical places where we're taking chemicals consistently. And I use the example of cannabis, because I've been smoking cannabis for almost over 20 years, man, and I smoke weed every single day, but it's changed dramatically since I was a child. You know, when I started smoking weed when I was in middle school, I would pass out everywhere. Like, I would be completely dysfunctional. I wouldn't be able to talk or make things make sense, you know. And nowadays I smoke weed and then I read hardcore intense philosophy, you know, like primary texts, and I try to digest Aristotle, and I'm taking notes and, you know, making up ideas for shows. Like, I'm so much more functional now, you know, and without cannabis I seem to be less functional. You know, I was like, the real intoxication comes from somebody not taking something they're used to, that they've been self-medicating themselves with. You know, there's a massive difference, you know. And he's like, well, a lot of these kids, they've never even tried kratom or regular opioids, you know. And I'm like, yeah, that's a crime that we don't have a sort of society that educates people on the chemical array at your disposal and what it means to be intoxicated, you know, and that there's this fucking spectrum of being when it comes to any sort of drug taking. You know, when I say microdose, I'm usually taking less than 0.2 of a gram, like 0.15, and most of what I get is a significant head change and a significant perception shift. It makes me think very differently, even though I wouldn't consider myself fucked up. You know, I'm not high, well, kind of, but like, it's the way that I think about my problems throughout the week. And it makes this moment, this microdose, almost like a holy, sacred moment. And then I marry it to my work, because work has always been one of the most difficult places for me to put myself, you know, and I struggled with boredom ever since I was a child. And I think when we have something that's tedious and that's repetitive, it becomes boring quickly. And the ultimate goal in life is to not let ourselves be bored, you know. And in like Buddhist meditative practices or just simple breath work, this idea of attention, you know, so we can take a tedious moment and we can turn it into a practice, just like watching the breath, you know, like, man. So I'm reading this book by David Gurdjieff, which last week I mentioned him, and he's not the same Gurdjieff that Ram Dass talks about. You know, there was an older Armenian philosopher from the early 1900s who goes by G.I. Gurdjieff, and he wrote a lot of stuff with Russian Uspensky. But David Gurdjieff is actually like an American, which makes sense because he has a PhD and he teaches in fucking America. And so I just kind of got that all twisted up in my wires, you know. But his whole technique and process in his book, Spiritual Realism, which is trying to divorce itself from the organized sense of religious thinking, which spirituality is often embedded within. But all of his techniques for attention come down to the breath. You know, and it's something that Ram Dass talks a lot about. And it's one of the main tools that's used in Zazen sitting, you know. And Zen Buddhism, I feel, is paramount when it comes to depicting this attentive moment, you know. And so I think even work with its tediousness, which can be miserable, is the ultimate opportunity for that practice if we shift how we think about it. You know, so I, out of fear, originally, when I started doing this over 10 years ago, it was because I knew that if I took a little bit of psilocybin that day, I would not be bored, because it shifts the mind and it puts you more present forward, that I feel it inevitably makes the work, like the actual production, what comes out of the work, not just your effort, you know, but when we're working, we're making something, whether it's a service or a commodity or something for somebody else, you know, we're making something out of our effort, and that is what work is. And then we turn that effort into some abstract idea of money, and we monetize it and we numeralize it, and we say that this amount of hours is this much of your effort, which is where it gets just so fucking stupid. But at the beginning of the base work, you know, even if you're not being paid for it, work is making something out of effort, you know. And a lot of the times, if you're making the same thing, that's where that tediousness comes from. But without a doubt, something about serotonergics in particular make it so that I don't have the capacity to be that kind of bored, you know. And I told a story, I think, a couple weeks ago, where the funny thing about these chemicals, these compounds, dimethyltryptamine, LSD, psilocybin, the serotonergics, is that they can be so oxymoronic, and it's not a spell. And with intentionality, we can hope to have a less boring day and then be given the opposite. You know, as a meaningful warning, you know, I've had a lot of shitty bad days because I would take psilocybin even if I was in a bad place mentally, you know? And unfortunately, I made myself suffer worse because I made myself more sensitive in the wrong time period, you know? But with the idea and open-mindedness to accept the next moment, the next tedium, you know, the same thing I've done 1,000 times, let's go get it, you know, and to feel part of our lives, you know, that's invaluable. And I had just such a good day today. I really did. I really, really am happy. And so I get done with my work, which only takes me about 4 or 5 hours. And then my father, who was watching my son, was nice enough to keep him for a little bit longer, and I went and rode my bike. And it's a beautiful summer sunny day, and the sun is shining, and pollen is falling everywhere like snow, and all the fields of grass with all their seed pods, well exposed and ready for pollination, or probably way after. But I just am very content. I'm happy with my life. You know, that's something I learned today. And then as I was biking home, within earshot of my house, about 5 or 10 minutes away, I ended up falling pretty hard, which I haven't fallen too many times on my bike since as an adult. But I like to go uphill on purpose, you know, because the reason that I use exercise the majority of the time is to burn out any excess frustration or discontent or Nez persona that I have embedded within myself. And I find that exercise helps the body do what it needs to do to burn out some of that stuff, because I think that it's not just mentally formed. I think it everything is intimately connected to our physical body. And so, you know, I find so much relief and release in exercise. But I plan my routes to go up all these uphill battles because I like the exertion and the effort. And it's strategic in some way, because especially on really steep dirt hills with rocks, you kind of have to like really ride your balance for a bit. And it excites me. And so I'm in this place where I'm going uphill on a dirt path. And I don't know what happened today, but I think I was just trying too hard and putting way too much pressure on my feet. And so when I was doing that, I was pulling on my handlebars and I'm pulling. And so super steep and I'm already inclined backwards a little bit. I pull on my handlebars and fucking pull my goddamn tire right off the ground. And I fell pretty hard. Luckily, I wasn't going too fast because I was struggling uphill. But I scratched the shit out of my arm and I got road rash all the way up and down my elbows and my everything. I haven't looked at my legs yet, but my legs are sore. At least it was the opposite side of my body than I felt last time. So I'll be evened out and I'll be walking straighter now. But yeah, get off that and I'm on the bike riding slowly back and I feel the adrenaline rush through my heart and it's kind of making me nauseous, and so I don't want to push too hard. I get back home and I smoked a little bit of DMT and I looked at all the pictures and realized that that didn't ruin my bike ride at all in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it almost caused an extra bit of excitement. Anyways, I don't mean to ramble too much about just what I fucking did today, but I've kind of been not thinking about this too much when I do it, when I'm not doing it. So I've been trying not to obsess about words. Like I was telling you last week, I haven't done a lot of planning. I've got some good ideas. But I definitely had a lot of lessons this week. So Tuesday comes around and I had intentions of microdosing a little bit of LSD because I haven't done that in a long time. And I'm getting home Monday evening and I come inside the house. And usually when I enter, I have a greeting almost always from my kitty cat. And if I don't get a greeting, usually pretty quickly I'll go back in some of the corners that she hides and I'll look and try to say hi, give her a little bit of love and affection. But this week I couldn't find her. And immediately I felt this sinking feeling. And so Odin comes in the house because he was riding his bike and I was like, I can't find the cat. So we both start searching the house and lo and behold, I become convinced that there's nowhere in the house that she could be hiding. So we go outside, and we start searching the neighborhood, and we get out on our bikes, and Odin goes one way and I go the other. And then after a while, I notice that I'm not seeing Odin, and so I have this double entendre of symbolism coming to me, because now I've lost my cat, and now I think my son's gone. And I got real scared, and I remember just riding around the neighborhood screaming his name, and turned out he had crossed the road and was looking in the trees on the other side of the park, which usually he's not allowed to go that far, but he was pretty distraught and upset and was worried about his kitty too, and so he was looking anywhere and everywhere, and he thought that this was probably extenuating circumstances. So he scared the bejesus out of me because I've been searching for him for 10 minutes. So we get him home, and at first I thought I wanted to go knock on doors, but I knocked on two neighbors' doors, nobody answered. I'm like, well, fuck. You know, how am I going to make a list of who I've talked to? So I start walking around again, and it's a huge apartment complex, and I start realizing the enormity of the world. And what am I supposed to do to triangulate and find her? So I'm rather crestfallen, rather depressed and sad. I really hadn't felt this stage of attachment to an animal since my dog died when I was a kid. And I think that after my dog died, I really kind of closed myself off to getting attached to animals, because when the next family dog died, I think I was the only one not crying, but it's because I never really gave myself completely to it. But with this cat, it's the first cat that I've ever really bonded to completely, and I didn't realize how attached I was until she was gone. And I started thinking, and all I did was really think about her for like 2 days, and it was like a breakup, you know, like I had to find all of her stuff and hide it, because if I saw her stuff, it'd make me really sad. And I put all of her stuff outside. I put her litter box, because I read if you make a scent station, it can blow her smell around and make it easier for her to find her way home. And I put her kitty tower out there and a bowl of food and some water, and none of it appears touched, you know. And I start trying to put myself into the headspace of her, and I realize that, you know, one, she's so terrified of people, so really, really terribly afraid of people, that I didn't think that she would let anybody pick her up, and I really doubted that she would go into anybody's house willingly. And I also knew that she was rather stupid, and I didn't think she can take care of herself, so my instinct was that she would hide, and I was worried that she would have hid out in the green space that's next to our apartment, because there's this little like sewage corridor and a bunch of trees grow around where all the water is. And if she got in there was 1,000 places she could have hid. And if she got into the sewage, I didn't know how I would find her. But this was all rather far away from the house, and it seemed hard to believe for me to think that she would be that far. So I'm just continuously thinking about her. And I'm rather sad. And I get to work Tuesday, and I went in sober because I knew that I was not in a pleasant headspace to handle anything. And I had a really, 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 really hard day. It was really rough. It was storming all day, thunderstorms. And I was just so sad, man. And everybody could tell. And I got through it, and we got home. And because it had been storming all day, her scent station was soaked, and all the used kitty litter was just swimming in water, so I had to go clean up all that mess. And I threw it all into a trash bag, and the whole time I'd almost kind of been like wagering with God, at least like the infantile version of God that I used to have in my head when I was a kid, that I would make promises to and make bets and beg for things. And you know, one of the things I said to the voice in my head that I call God was, you know, like, if you give me my cat back, I'll feed her twice a day every day. I promise. I don't care if she gets fat. You know, I'm like just making all these wagers. And, you know, part of that voice was in my head as I'm walking this trash out to that dumpster. And I've looked for her 3 times, and I'm looking in all the patios every time I'm going through the apartments, whether I'm in a car or on the bike or on foot. And you know, I haven't looked under the dumpster specifically, but I thought about it. And so I look under the dumpsters there, no cat. And so I'm walking back, and it's a short walk, about 80 feet from the dumpsters to my apartment. And in front of my apartment is a green square. And then around that green yardy square is 4 sets of apartments, all facing towards them. And so outside of this apartment area in the parking lot is where the dumpster is. So I'm walking past 2 apartments to get to my apartment. So there's 2 patios that I can look in, and I'm looking in all the grass, and I'm looking in the trees and the bushes and underneath all their patio furniture. And my neighbor directly next door to me has this really low couch that sits maybe an inch off the ground, like super, super squat, like couch thing. And I hadn't exactly gotten down on my hands and knees and looked all the way under it because it was so low. And I didn't really think it was big enough to fit her because she's such a huge fat cat. But I got down on the sidewalk and I get down into the push-up position and I lower myself down, nose to the concrete, and I look over, and right in the back corner of their patio, in the farthest back area underneath this little tiny couch, is my cat all curled up, and I could see her looking at me. So I went over and I started moving all the shit around, moved the couch and got her out, and she starts to run towards the patio with the door shut, and so she's runs back around towards the front door. So I open up the patio real quick. I'm like, oh, get out, watch this fucking area, make sure you see if she walks out of this area, because I want to know where she goes. She didn't have a collar. I had no way to find her. That was one of the things that was really bothering me, you know. And got her in, you know, and it was one of the best feelings that I've ever felt in my life. Just the relief, the release of suffering, because I was in such a pit of darkness for like 48 hours almost. And to have that instantaneous relief, it was one of the best feelings that I've ever had. And this kind of connects back to my topic from last week, where of course we can insert artificial suffering, which is necessary. But the world also gives us a bountiful platter of opportunities to deal with the darker sides of our natures and our feelings. And one of the best opportunities that the world gives us is in loss, and when the people we love die. And during this whole time of starting the process of grieving my cat, I was also thinking about all the people I've lost and all the connections that there are between loss and death and all of it. And it really does have to do with attachment. It has to do with how we start to put pieces of ourselves onto this other. And it points towards the interconnectedness that I speak all about, because it would be impossible to have those feelings if a part of you wasn't in that being, you know? Like, almost a part of the mourning is because we've lost a piece of ourselves. We've lost the chance to have conversations. Or in my case, I was thinking about feeding the damn thing. You know, like, I woke up that morning, I didn't get to feed her, and that fucking killed me. And I woke up the next day and was just so fucking happy and just really, really grateful that I could feed her. You know, so it taught me a lot. And another thing I saw was just the community aspect. Like, the neighbors that did help out were amazing. They sent their kids out. And there's this really cool app that's existing now called Nextdoor, and it's like Facebook for neighbors. And so it connects you to the people close to you, which I think is fabulous. And my neighbor told me to make a post of the cat, and just, you know, because she didn't have a collar, just for identification. So a couple pictures from a couple different angles with my contact information so they could call me, you know. But of course, she was less than 10 feet away from the apartment the entire time. And even though she was within earshot of us, hearing us look for her, she didn't touch her food the entire time. So I'm very sure she stayed under that couch the entire time, which is fucking ridiculous. But I'm also glad. But you know, the people were really nice on this app. Very kind. And so I feel like I felt everything this week, all the ups, all the downs, and I learned a lot. That's the point of living. It's what we're doing here. This is all of our individual training days as we create our own worlds. And so you look at what you get, and then you transmute it into meaning. That personal meaning is alchemy, as you transform yourself into the world that you want to see, and vice versa. It's all intimately enmeshed. Well, I think that's all I can banter this week. Let me go find your quote, and we'll sign you off. So I like this part from David Gurdjieff's book called Spiritual Realism, where he's discussing his, I'll probably read the whole thing, actually. This is his technique for breath counting, which this is a super, super ubiquitous practice, all the way from Christian mystics to Hinduism to Buddhists. You know, counting your breath is an old, old method for focus and training one-pointedness, as well as calming the body and learning how to have this mind-body connection. My point is that this is not strictly a religious or a spiritual thing, or even David's thing. You know, this is a thing that I think sometimes people do naturally, but it's difficult. Here we go. Counting your breath. The first technique that we can use to strengthen our general awareness and weaken our attachment to our sense of self is to watch our breath. It is deceivingly simple and extremely powerful. Here's the technique. Sit comfortably. You do not have to sit cross-legged in a lotus position from the east. There's nothing magical about different postures. All you need to do is sit comfortably. In fact, it isn't even necessary to be comfortable, but it helps. If you're not comfortable, you will be distracted. With practice, however, your discomfort may even be of some help. To start with, you should just sit up straight in a chair or on the floor and try not to slouch. Slouching might feel good in the beginning, but it leads to discomfort after a while. Notice that I said sit rather than lie. Why do you not want to lie down? What usually happens when you do? We go to sleep. It is extremely difficult to stay awake and perform this technique if you're lying down. Try it, and if you can stay awake, great. You're one of the lucky ones. Step two, close your eyes or gently focus your attention on a place on the floor in front of you that is comfortable. Try not to move your eyes around much. When your eyes move, your attention moves and you're not working on the technique. Try the technique with your eyes closed first. Some people tend to doze off when they have their eyes closed or they lose their concentration a bit. If you feel comfortable doing the technique with your eyes closed, great. You don't have to worry about your eyes wandering around. Step three, breathe normally through your nose. There are many techniques out there that involve control of the breath. Some ask you to breathe in deeply, hold the breath for a few seconds, and then breathe out. There's no problem with doing this for a few repetitions, but if it is used as a primary technique, it may cause some problems. It's hard to imagine a benefit from tampering with your natural respiratory process. Beware. Step four, count your breath. As you breathe in through your nose at a natural rate, slowly say to yourself, one. As you breathe out, say along, one. Again. As you breathe in again, say slowly to yourself, two. As you breathe out again, you guessed it, along, two. Continue this until you get through 10, then repeat the process. If you lose your count, don't be frustrated. Just start over with one. Step five, repeat for 30 minutes each day. It's that simple. You probably want to start off with a lot less than 30 minutes. 5 or 10 minutes is probably a good starting place. There's no rush. You start off with whatever is comfortable for you. Remember, this technique is supposed to make you happier, not frustrated. Let's try this technique for 10 minutes. Good luck. Put the book down and try it now for 10 minutes. Just count your breath, 1 through 10, for 10 minutes. What happened? Did you even try the technique? If you did, fantastic. Many of you probably did not. We often seek intellectual stimulation but don't take the action that makes the intellectual understanding a reality. The importance of practicing the technique was mentioned repeatedly throughout this book. In fact, it was even stated that nothing in this book should be simply accepted intellectually, that unless we experience what is written, it will be worthless. How come we don't act, do things that we know will make a positive impact on our life? As foolish as it sounds, many of us are afraid that we may change. We pick up books like this because we'd like to make a change in our lives, but when it comes to actually making the change, we are often afraid and don't take the necessary action. Take the action. There's nothing to fear, nothing worth clinging to. You will change. You will be happy with that change. Try the technique right now for 10 minutes if you didn't do it earlier. So what happened? Did you lose your count? Was it relaxing? If you are like most people, you started out fine, but quickly lost your count. You may have even forgotten what your task was as your thoughts drifted off to 1,000 different places. At some point, you probably became aware that your mind was drifting off and you weren't counting your breath anymore. You may have scolded yourself and started counting again. You probably drifted off again and became even more frustrated with yourself when you noticed your inability to do the technique properly. Some of you may have been great breath counters. You may have gotten to the number 20 or 30 before you realized that you were supposed to start over once you reached the number 10. You then became a bit frustrated with yourself and started the process over. Many of you may have realized while doing this technique that you really didn't want to do it. It is intellectually stimulating to read about things that challenge your way of thinking or echo beliefs you may have understood but never thought of concretely. You may have said to yourself that the technique is silly, that you don't really need it, that you can't get the same results without it. Others may find the technique incredibly boring and an extreme disappointment after all the allusions to greater happiness and contentment made throughout the book. Sorry, the technique itself is not designed to meet your expectations. Its purpose is not to feed your ego, your sense of self. Who is it that is bored? Who is it that is disappointed? That is an important point. The whole point of this technique is to weaken, not strengthen, your attachment to your sense of self. Of course, you'll be bored and disappointed with the technique. You should be. Some of you may have found the technique relaxing. Some of you may have found yourself more stressed after doing the technique than before you started. Both are normal. Neither really matters. Over time, with continued practice, you'll find the technique very satisfying, almost addictive. It is your escape from your illusory self, and it feels good. With continued practice, this experience permeates your daily life. You spend most of your time happy, content, and feeling more alive. Sorry, I took the long road there. I was only planning on reading a segment, but I did the whole fucking thing. But I like it. You know, and I've read almost this exact same tutorial in old Buddhist books. You know, so it's like, he did not make this shit up. This is stuff we've been doing for millennia. It's one of the most important things that I ever learned was how to watch my breath. I don't even count, because after that comes watching. You don't really necessarily need to count. And in Zen Buddhism, they call that Shikan Taza, which basically is just watching what's happening. Then you forget the breath and you just watch what's going around. You just attend to reality. Anyways, I hope you were able to get something out of that. It's probably one of the best quotations and the most important quotations that I've ever read on the show. I feel like I should make a little tiny blurb for that one so it's easy to get. Have like little tiny episodes with quotations of important books. Anyways, thank you all for your time. I'll forever be grateful for this opportunity that you've allowed me to try to be helpful and to be a support for you. So go support others and love yourself. And we'll see you next week.
Hello, it's Oscar with the Gingerbread Man. It hasn't been a long time, but it just feels like for me.
A week is a long time for a kid.
Yeah, I agree for kids.
My hand hurts.
Did you talk about it?
I did, a little bit. Oh, well. This guy right here. You have any important news to say? Any instructional pieces of advice for anybody? I did.
Oh.
That was my main point. You can talk about it if you want.
Yeah, like, my dad has been talking about it. I asked him if, yeah, I was like,
yeah. What are like you talking about?
I'm glad we found our cat.
Yeah, you were pretty sad, huh?
Yeah.
It was really hard.
It was really hard, especially for you.
Yeah. You get big feelings when you get bigger, I guess.
I guess that's true.
Makes noise. All that gets picked up because it's all connected. It's a very sensitive microphone.
Very. Yeah, I can see it. It is very sensitive. All right.
Have a good week.
Yeah, have a good week. Bye.
Bye.